Great, thank you. We are going to not necessarily solve the problem of distraction in the sense of, getting more focusing techniques, but rather we're going to learn a Hasidic text that really tries to reframe how we should think about distraction. And this is a text that's actually really beautiful. The text begins to talk about faith, and then continues to talk about distraction in prayer, and then brings us back to the theme of faith, which is one of the reasons why I chose to do it today in a Yom Iyun that's dedicated to faith and doubt. This is an extremely complex text. I didn't say that before when I was pitching the class. It's extremely complex. I have 100% faith that we will all do a great job and we will all understand it, but it is complex. And I will try my best to walk you through it. I've got 2 boards, 6 markers. I made us this incredible chart, which I'm going to pass around when it's relevant. So just try to stay with me. And I am going to be speaking a little bit more frontally than I usually like to do, because this text, to do it really well, I would have needed 2 hours. And I said, I'm happy to do this text, Shai, if you give me 2 hours. And Shai said, sure. But I didn't get 2 hours. Which, of course, makes a lot more sense for the other classes, and I understand why I didn't get 2 hours, but we are going to have to find a way to get those 45 minutes in another form. And one of those ways is that I'm going to talk a lot and hand out this amazing chart that I made, and hopefully we'll all be able to stay together, stay on pace. I'd actually like us to start with page 3. So if you flip past your first page, just on to page 3, the first text on the page is the Mishnah in Brachot. Great. Gordon, would you like to read the Mishnah in either Hebrew or English?
Ein omdin lehitpalel ela mitoch kovod rosh. Chasidim harishonim hayu shochin sha'a achat mitpalelim. כדי שיכוונו את ליבם למקום. אפילו המלך שואל בשלמה, לא ישיבנו, ואפילו נחש כרוך על יקבו, לא יפסיק.
Good. Right, so we have this Mishnah that's talking about seriousness. Prayer is serious and requires a lot of focus. So much focus that there were people that would sit and meditate before and meditate after to get into the place of prayer and to sort of allow themselves to come back from the place of prayer. And there's this extremely high standard of depth of concentration and depth of presence, where even what seem to be fairly threatening distractions, a king who has a tremendous amount of power to endanger your life and demand a lot of respect, or a snake, which could maybe be poisonous, you got to stay focused, you don't interrupt, and you maintain your serious posture throughout all of prayer. That's what the Mishnah says. And then the Gemara comes and says, I want to soften this a little bit. You don't actually have to put your life in danger. Rav Sheshet says, Lo shano ela nachash. They only taught this regarding a snake. Aval akrav, but a scorpion, posek. Then you could stop. Right, so if I have a garden snake wrapped around my ankle, I just say, hello, garden snake, and then I continue to pray. But if there is something that is really threatening my life, I can go. And the Degel Machane Ephraim, the Hasidic text that we are going to look at, focuses on this text. And he's really trying to get at not the physical difference between a snake and a scorpion, but the spiritual difference between a snake and a scorpion. Because if a snake or a scorpion represents what might distract you from prayer, I need to figure out the difference between a distraction that I pray through and a distraction that I would stop myself for. Okay? So based on this Mishnah, the snake comes to represent something that distracts you from prayer. Okay. If you flip over to page 5... we are not going to look at this text inside, but I want to point to you to a special word in this teaching, akev, the ankle or the heel. So the snake in the Mishnah is wrapped around your ankle, wrapped around your heel, and the Kedushat Levi is going to bring to us this larger Hasidic teaching that connects the heel of your foot to faith. And this is going to be the linchpin for the Degel Machaneh Ephraim between our Mishnah, which talks about prayer, and the notion of faith. And, of course, Parashat Ekev, which he is going to be speaking about. So if you move to the middle of the text, you'll see, and the general principle is, I'm just going to go through this very quickly, the general principle is that just as a person has a head, heel, and hands, so too there is a beginning, middle, and end in the service of the Blessed Creator. There are levels to God's service. And if you skip all the way to the bottom, and the second aspect is in which one serves the Blessed Creator because of faith, that he believes in God's divinity and God's oneness and serves God. This aspect is called heel, for it is the end of the level, meaning the highest connection to God is really knowing God, and that's with your head. And the lowest level is your heel, is your foot, and that is faith, that's believing in God, which is a lower way of accessing than your head, which is belief. Sorry, your head, which is knowledge or complete comprehension. I don't want to get too lost in this. I just want to show you, right? These are the pieces that the Degel Machaneh Ephraim is coming into when he is giving his treatise on Parashat Ekev. One piece is you have the distracting snakes around your heel, and the other piece is that your heel has something to do with faith. It somehow represents the level of faith. How are we doing so far? Good. Okay. Now we can go to the first page and actually get into the meat of the text. V'haya Ekev Tishmun. And the consequence, Ekev, will be if you listen to these laws and you are careful to keep them, that Hashem your God will keep for you the covenant and kindness that he has promised to your fathers. Okay. Klal gadol avodat habarei baruch hu. There's a great principle in the service of the Blessed Creator. Ha'ikar hu hahamana. The core is faith/reliance. Right? And notice he doesn't say emuna. He says ha'amana. Right? Which gives you more of a sense of reliance than what emuna would be, which would be a more spiritual or intellectual posture of faith or belief. Okay? And my grandfather, the holy Baal Shem Tov, would instruct about this. This is the root of all service and all Torah. And this is what King David said, Kol mitzvotecha emuna, sheker radfuni azarani. All of your mitzvot are faith. Help me, for I have been chased by falsehood. The pshat of this verse in Tehillim is, God, all of your mitzvot can be trusted. All of them are faithful. And the drasha is, actually, all of the mitzvot can be considered a type of faith, right? That you could actually reduce every single different type of law to, you got to have faith. Everything is about faith. Okay, so we shifted to emunah as being an adjective that applies to every mitzvah, to emunah being the content of every mitzvah. That's what the drasha is here from the Baal Shem Tov. He inherits this. Okay. That the core of mitzvot is faith, that is to have faith in God. And one who does have faith in God can pray every day. I want us to pause here. If I were just to stop here, what does faith mean and how is it connected to prayer?
Faith enables you to pray.
Good, right? Faith is a prerequisite for prayer. And what kind of faith is this? Well, what's our default definition of what faith is?
Believing that there's somebody there to pray to.
Great, right? At this point, it seems like what faith is belief in God's existence. And if you don't believe in God's existence, how could you pray? That's where we are at this point. And this seems like a very straightforward, not radical, kind of old, right, understanding of the connection between faith and prayer. You believe in God, you pray to God, done.
And what's the connection with mitzvot?
Well, the connection. Well, we'll see more of a connection with mitzvot. But, yeah, but the reason why he needs to bring in this text, right, is that he is quoting the Baal Shem Tov, who says that all service of God is faith, and he has to quote the Baal Shem Tov faithfully, right? And since the Baal Shem Tov's teaching was about doing mitzvot and praying, even though he's more interested in the prayer aspect, he's going to quote his grandfather accurately and bring in this verse and the Baal Shem Tov's little midrash on this verse that reduces all of religious practice to prayer, to faith. That makes sense? There's a part that he's using for his own purposes, but he's still quoting the entirety of it faithfully.
When it says, this is the root of all Torah and all avodah, I'm assuming that means prayer?
Yeah.
And what is the root?
Faith. Believing in God's existence at this point.
So it doesn't subscribe to the idea of mitoch shelo ba'al lishma.
At this point, it just seems like, in a very straightforward, non-sophisticated way, of course you need to have faith in God to serve God and to pray to God. Done. And so therefore, in some sense, all of the service of God, all of the mitzvot, everything can be just be reduced to this notion of faith. It requires faith, it is faith, done. But we are not even a quarter of the way through. Okay? So we're continuing on. That is, okay, and so now when he's explaining himself, he's also shifting his definition of belief. That is that if he has faith that every day God renews creation, he is a new creature every day, and all of the worlds are new creations. Okay? So we shifted from a belief in God, that God exists, to a belief about God, about himself, and about the world, and that is that God renews the world every day, that I myself am a new creature every day, and the world every day is different. We're going to continue on, and then I'm going to explain. And he needs to pray and to give praise and thanks to the one who created everything and also created him, to pray for his life and the life of his wife and children and his livelihood and all good things. But if he does not believe with complete faith that God renews creation every day, then the tefillah and mitzvot become for him like something old and routine. And it becomes revolting to him to say the identical things every day. Right? This is exactly what we're talking about. It's not about belief. Even if you believe in God, that God exists, you would still have the problem of prayer is boring. I say the same thing every day. But if you have faith that God renews the world, if you have faith that you're a new person every day, if you have faith that God is a new God every day, right? What you've shifted to is a mindset of possibility. I am praying every day because I believe that just because something was the way it was yesterday doesn't mean that that's how it's going to be tomorrow. And the faith that you need in order to pray is faith in change. You have to believe that the world is not static, that the world is changing. Right? And in some sense, this is in total contrast to a classic idea of faith. Classic idea of faith is God's got the whole world in God's hands, everything is stable. And the Deva Machana Ephraim says in order to pray, you need to actually believe that the world is unstable. Because believing that the world is unstable invites the possibility of change. Just because I'm poor today doesn't mean I'm going to be poor tomorrow. Just because I'm sad today doesn't mean I'm going to be sad tomorrow. And then you feel this sense of possibility on the one hand, and also, this is very important, a sense of desperation. Just because I'm rich today doesn't mean that I'll be rich tomorrow. Just because I'm married today doesn't mean that I'll be married tomorrow. And so there's this sense of fundamental insecurity and fundamental hope that is necessary for all prayer. I think if we were to stop here, it would be enough, right? So important and also so non-theistic. You don't need to believe that God exists to believe in the possibility of change. You could teach this to anyone. I advise you to teach this to your congregations and whomever. For me, this has been a life-changing attitude. That what I need to pray only is a faith in possibility. It's a faith in change. Okay. We're going to continue on a little bit. And this is what my grandfather, now he's quoting the Baal Shem Tov again. Yeah.
So we just shifted from faith and change, from faith in God to faith in change.
Right. Moving from the idea that God exists to the idea that God, and I would say any principle, is constantly recreating the world. You're different, the world is different, the circumstances are different. So we've shifted from an image of stability to an image of possibility. Okay. And he doesn't say this, but I added that also, that can be extremely frightening. Right? If you're doing well, the notion that anything could change is very destabilizing. If you're doing not well, the notion that anything can change is very hopeful. And it really just depends on where you are. Okay. And this is what my grandfather said in the verse, Al tashlicheni le'etzikna, do not discard me at the time of aging, really at the time of oldness. Meaning that the matter will be old to him. The way that the Baal Shem Tov understood Al tashlicheni le'etzikna is, don't let me become fossilized. Don't let me become old and set in my ways and bored. I want to have the excitement and the vitality of youth. It's not about chronological age. It's about psychological age. It's about the sense of, I've got my whole life in front of me. I can choose whatever path I want. That's what it means to be young. And when the Baal Shem Tov said, don't cast me away in old age, is don't make me feel old. And I think we all know that there are plenty of people who are young and are fixed, and people who are old and have a tremendous sense of possibility. Okay. For just as aging causes weakness in all of the limbs of a person, due to the fact that his strength and suppleness and flow of the blood which sustains a person weaken, similarly in matters of the spirit, something which is old and aged does not have enjoyment and great liveliness and no new component. And this is the meaning of ki chadashim lav karim. Sorry. Bechol yom yiyu beinecha kechadashim. That they should be every day in your eyes as new. For they are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. Okay, so here we're doing another drasha. Chadashim lav karim rabba emunatecha. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. Meaning God, you can be dependent upon to make everything new. That's the pshat of the pasuk. Meaning that through the new every morning, and here's the drash, through the fact that everything is new every morning, through that, great is your faith. It turns out that the root of tefillah and mitzvot is faith. Mm-hmm. I just want to explain this a little bit more clearly. It's not that God renews everything, and therefore God is faithful. It's that what faith is the belief that God renews everything. Okay. I want to pause here, though we don't have a tremendous amount of time, to take two insights or questions or reflections. So now's the time to get your hand in the air. Yeah, Nina.
I just noticed it makes us such an active agent and a co-creator, which is infinitely more interesting and attention-grabbing. So.
Right, right. It's not that you have to only believe that God renews the world every day. God renews you every day. Yeah. And you have to, in order to make that true, mm-hmm. you need to believe it. And if you believe it, you can make it true.
Mm-hmm. Great. Any other question or insight? Sometimes those are the same thing.
Wow.
Wow.
Well, this goes.
We'll
accept
that.
This goes completely. I spoke about this. I don't know. It was last week because I did a whole workshop on prayer, and I talked about the difference between being yotze, you know, yotze,
right. Checking off the box,
checking off the box that you did what you had to do, and the concept of lehit palel, which is a reflexive verb that says you're doing something to yourself, you're doing self-evaluation, and you're engaged and involved, and it should be a transforming experience.
Right. Right. The notion that we pray, too, might actually be a misunderstanding of the grammar of prayer, mm-hmm. which is reflexive. Beautiful. Okay, we'll take one more comment.
I'll just throw it away, but...
Okay.
I'm working on Groundhog Day here, and that the worst nightmare, the worst hell on earth, is to being be stuck in the same place every
Amen.
Day.
Amen. Yeah, thank you. And thank you for the brevity of your comment. Okay, so far, so good. Things are pretty comprehensible. But welcome to the part of the teaching where he goes into the Zohar. Not just one Zohar, but two Zohars. You're welcome. Okay, I'm going to do my best to make these as straightforward and comprehensible as possible, but I am human. I am not 40, and I can only do the best that I can. So if you have your handy-dandy chart, which I just made 45 minutes ago, I was like, I need a chart to help me understand. And then I thought to myself, maybe so does my class. So if you look at the top of the chart, we have the Nachash. That's the snake, the non-poisonous snake, versus the Akrav, the poisonous scorpion. The snake represents continuing to pray, because if there's a snake around your heel, you're still going. But if there's an Akrav around your heel, you stop praying. We've got through the first two boxes on our chart. We're doing great. Let's go into the Zohar. We're on page 3, source number 2. And here we have a parable of a king and his son and the king's messenger. Okay? Should be good. This one we'll do inside because it's a little bit more straightforward, and the Tikkuni Zohar I will just sort of describe to you what's happening outside of the text. But we're starting with, rather, he is definitely doing the will of his master. If anybody wants to follow along in the Aramaic, all power to you, but I will be going through the English. We're on page 3, source number 2. Yeah, good, thank you. Rather, he is definitely doing the will of his master. The he here is the Yetzer Hara. Okay, the evil inclination is doing the will of the evil inclination's master, that is God. Right, and one of the preoccupations of Kabbalistic thought is, does evil have its own independent existence? How do I understand evil if God is entirely good? And this is one of the metaphors that we're using to understand the function of the Yetzer Hara. And before I go into this text, if you are a male Kabbalist and you are praying, what is the single most threatening kind of distracting or intrusive thought?
Sexuality.
Good. I didn't have to say it, you said it, okay? So the most threatening thought is a woman, a foreign woman. Okay? So that's one of the reasons why this text is going to be so powerful for the Dagel Machane Ephraim, because it really gets to the kind of thought that he's trying to keep out. Okay? Rather, he, the Yetzer Hara, is definitely doing the will of his master. This is analogous to a king, God, who had only one son, us, and he loved him exceedingly. So far, so good. And he commanded him, out of love, that he not bring himself close to a bad woman, because anyone who brings himself close to a bad woman is not worthy to enter into the palace of the king. Certain amount of sexual purity required to be in the palace. Okay. The son agreed to do the will of his father out of love in the house of the king. Outside, there was one prostitute who was beautiful, and the description used here is Yafat Toar v'Yafat Mareh, right? And this is a description of beauty that applies to heroines in the Bible.
Rachel, right?
Yes. Okay, so you already know that because this prostitute is being described in a flattering type of beauty, she's going to end up being a heroine. Okay? Heroine with an E. Okay. Some time passed, and the king said, I want to show the goodwill of my son towards me. I want to prove to myself that my son loves me. So what does he do? He called to the prostitute and said to her, go and seduce my son to show the goodwill of my son towards me. What did that prostitute do? She followed after the son of the king. She tried to hug him and to kiss him and to seduce him with all manner of enticements. If the son is fitting and submits to the commandment of his father, he will rebuff her and will not submit to her and will push her away from him. The father will rejoice. in his son and bring him into the curtain of his palace and will give him gifts, presents, and great wealth, right? If you are able to not give in to your sexual desires, you are going to be in the palace of the king. It's going to be awesome. Okay. Who caused all of this great wealth to come to the son? I will say it is that prostitute. And does this prostitute deserve praise for this or not? She definitely deserves praise from all sides. One, that she has done the commandment of the king. The king said, go seduce my son. And the prostitute said, he nanny, on it. Okay? And two, that she caused that son to get all of the goodness and love. If she hadn't tested the son and the son hadn't been successful, the son would never have received all of the wealth and all the closeness to his father. On this it says, and it was very good, v'hine tov me'od. And it was good, this is the angel of life. Very good, this is the angel of death. For he is definitely very good to the one who obeys the commandments of his master. Okay? The reason why we have this evil inclination is because God sends that evil inclination. And the reason why God sends the evil inclination is because ultimately it's going to redound good for us. So the evil inclination, the Malach HaMavet, this beautiful prostitute, all three are really the same, right? Actually, this is Tov Mo'od. This is good. Without the prostitute's seduction, or attempted seduction, you would be at the level of Tov. You would be obedient. But with the level of the seduction, you enter Tov Me'od because you know that you actually are able to withstand temptation and you've proven your love, you've proven your dedication to God.
Who is the he in the last one?
He is the evil inclination or the angel of death.
So the evil inclination is very good to the one who obeys the commandments.
Exactly. Right, and his master is both the master of the evil inclination and the master of the son, of us, right? Both of these, our desire to do what's right and this temptation to do what's wrong, come from God. Okay, one story of the Zohar, and you can see on your chart, we have the prostitute comes from the king. I tried to make the language extremely simple. She is good, exclamation point. A, you obey the king by resisting her. B, she obeys the king by testing you. Okay. So if I were to just stop here, we have this actually very flattering picture of distracting thoughts, of sexual temptation. As long as I don't submit, I'm actually getting stronger and better and more wealth and more gifts, and it's awesome. Okay. Now we're going to go to the Tikkuni Zohar, which is source 3 on your text. I am just going to tell you the story. And then I'll explain it through the chart. Essentially, this is a passage that talks about prayer. Okay, so of course we always have to have something that connects us back to prayer. And we have Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, talking to the Chaverim, his, you know, circle of friends. And we're imagining a scene where everybody's praying together. They're a minyan. And of course, 10 is a very significant Kabbalistic number. And there's a member of the group that is straggling. They're praying, and they can't seem to finish praying. And Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai says, you need to wait for that person. Because the reason why that person is taking so long to pray is because they're actually struggling with their prayer. There's something about that prayer that is having difficulty pushing through to God. And you can't abandon that person who's praying. You need to be there so that you can lift up their prayer. And then he says that without that person's prayer, your prayers wouldn't go through. Right? Every member of the minyan needs every other member of the minyan. The people who seem strong, the people who seem righteous, and the people who seem weak, the people who seem poor, the people who are struggling. Everybody needs each other. And moving into the sexual metaphor, the poor person who's having difficulty with their prayer, that is the Shekhinah. That is the lowest
of all of the 10 sefirot. And the people who are succeeding in their prayer, they are Yesod or Tzaddik. They are basically, this is God's feminine aspect. And this is God's phallus, as it were. Thank God for Greek and Latin. Okay. So they need each other, right, to make this union. So the tzaddikim, the people that are doing great in prayer, they want to leave the slowest, lowest person behind. But actually, if they leave the slowest, lowest person behind, they won't be able to achieve this unity. Right, in prayer, particularly for the Kabbalists and the Hasidim, when we talk about dvekut and sort of cleaving to God in prayer, there's also, at least metaphorically, sexual element here. You need to have this unity in order for your prayer to work. Okay. So far, so good.
Unity with one another.
Unity with one another, exactly. Thank you. And the unity with one another is representative and therefore causes, in this kind of theurgic way, unity in the Godhead. Okay. But there is an exception given in the Tikkuni Zohar for this idea that we're all just going to pray together and everything's going to be great. The exception to that is the image of Yosef and Eshet Potiphar, Joseph and Potiphar's wife. There, Potiphar's wife tries to seduce him, and Joseph runs away. Joseph, in this map of God, well, this eight-tenths of a map, I mean two-tenths of a map of God, Joseph is referred to as the tzaddik. So whatever Joseph does is what the tzaddik does. So we have this image also of a tzaddik who says, I got to get away from this bad influence. I got to run away from this bad influence. And that is that Eshet Potiphar represents Avodah Zarah. She represents idolatrous worship. And you can't. Right? You can raise the sparks of all sorts of things, but you got to draw the line at idol worship. You actually can't go there. You got to step away. Okay. And the last piece I want us to get to before I just summarize what we've seen is one of the reasons that we're told that you actually need to be sensitive to this person who is strangling is that this person seems like they're a threat, but actually aren't a threat. So if you look at the second to last box on your page where I wrote Echad and then Acher, this text talks about Akev and the snake that we learned in our Mishnah, and says that the person who is like straggling along is the Akev, right? When I walk, the thing that goes, that straggles is always my heel. It's the last part of my body, okay? So the straggler in this minyan is the Akev of this minyan. And this person is grabbing onto the heel. This person is the nachash who wraps around the ankle, wraps around the heel of the person who's praying, because they're trying to be dragged along. So when you see this snake trying to grab your heel while you're praying, it's not coming to distract you from praying. It wants to pray too. And so it like grabs onto your ankle and it shuckles when you shuckle. But the scorpion doesn't want to pray with you. The scorpion is trying to kill you. The scorpion is trying to distract you from prayer. So you pray with the snake, but you run away from the scorpion. And what he describes as what's happening with the snake is that it's also grabbing onto the akev of the word echad. Shema Yisrael, Shem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. It is trying to make it into your prayer. But when you look at it, it looks like it's a threat because it's grabbed on to the little back of the Dalet, And when it eats the little back of the Dalit, it looks like a resh. I know.
Wow.
Yeah. And you think it's saying, God forbid, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Acher.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which is basically the most idolatrous thing you could say. God is something else. God is not our God. God is something else. So you see the straggler nibbling on the back of the Dalit, and you think, oh my God, this snake is a distraction. But then it turns out that the snake is actually just nibbling because it wants to ride along, and it's not saying Acher. But the Akrav is saying Acher. Okay, the Akrav is idolatry. And you have to figure out, is this like a happy, nibbly snake? Or is this a scary, bitey, Eshet Potifar snake? Okay. That should all be abundantly clear from this chart.
Oh, it's clear from the chart, but
Good. Well, we are going to take all of this highly interesting Kabbalistic information and bring it back into the Degel Machaneh Ephraim. I promise you, it's worth it. Okay. I mean, even the Dalit Reish thing, even if you don't, it's still cute. You're getting something. I even put, like, little diamonds on the snake. Come on.
It's cute. He's got a little eye.
Yeah, he's got an eye.
He's a regular snake.
Yeah, I'll tell you, speaking to the artist, when I was creating this beautiful work of visual art, I was thinking to myself, it needs to be a snake that looks like it could be dangerous. So I gave him a rattle. Mm-hmm. You're welcome. Okay. Now we are going back to the second half of the Degel Machaneh Ephraim, which actually begins on page 1. When you get together with the people in the other class, you could say, we got a real workout. Vizehu, and this is, afilu nachash karuch ala kavo, lo yafsik, avala krav, posek. Meaning, that a foreign thought is called a snake. So, what's going on here? How do I understand the Mishnah? Meaning that even if a foreign thought surrounds a person, he should not stop praying. Why? And now we're going to bring it back to faith. For if he believes with a complete faith that there is a creator of everything and that he is the king of the world, certainly this foreign thought has come to be righted in order to raise it to its root, like the parable of the one who is standing before the king. We're just going to continue. It is certainly disrespectful of one of the servants or ministers of the king to call him from before him and interrupt him with nonsense. For certainly the one who does this will owe his head to the king. Rather, one who does this, definitely, presumably, does so at the command of the king, or in order that he understand that also the one who summons and interrupts him also needs the king. But he is unable to approach the king in sackcloth. Therefore, he asks from him, since it is the time to speak before the king, so that he'll remember him, to remove his sackcloth and clothe him in fine and beautiful garments, so that he too will be able to come before the king. Okay, let's just pause here. The first image that we have is the image that we have like from the Zohar, and from the Tikkuni Zohar, actually. It's kind of a melding of both. There's a distracting thought. There's a snake, right, coming to your leg. And the reason why it's distracting you is because it needs to approach the king. And it can't do it when it's dressed in sackcloth. It actually needs you to help it approach, right? And we know that everything in the world comes from the behest of God. So if this thing is trying to get at you, it also is part of God's system. It also is good. And you need to pay attention to it and figure out what it's doing. Okay? And so here he's sort of reverting back to the more classical understanding of belief in God. That is, that everything in the world comes from God. And if you really believe in God, you'll believe that even this distracting thought is coming to you from God. And the reason why it needs you, the reason why it's like banging at your head, is because you are going to help it get from its low place to the king. You're going to bring it up in your prayer. Right? So the first thing that he's actually asking you to do is look at that distracting thought as something that needs to be incorporated in your prayer. The reason why it's coming to you now is because it's relevant. And I think that probably the best example of this in my... Let me just finish. I think the best example of this is when you're praying about, you know, resurrecting the Davidic kingdom, and your mind moves to, you're really worried about the health of a parent or a grandparent. And there's one way of reading that as, I really should be talking about the Davidic kingdom now. Why am I being so distracted by thoughts of my sick relative? But that's not what's going on. You need to bring those thoughts. That's actually what you care about. That's actually what's bothering you. And if it didn't hit you during prayer, you wouldn't pray about it, right? So instead of thinking this is a distraction from my prayer, think of it as this is something that's knocking on the door and saying, I need to get into your prayer. I'm actually something that's very important to you, and you need to take me with you when you pray. I need your path to the king. I think it's a little bit harder, right, to apply this to, let's say, TV or like something kind of what we would think as being like very pedestrian as part of our prayer. But I think with enough Freudian analysis, you could see, right, why is this the TV show that like, or the joke that keeps on coming to me? Why do I think that this joke is so hilarious that I need to laugh at it during the Bracha of Modim or during Psukei Dezimra? There's something about that joke that is connecting to you in this very powerful way, that it's coming even when it's not bidden, but it's knocking, and you're supposed to let it in. Okay. What was your question about the root?
I said, is that what it means, that this foreign thought has come to be righted in order to raise it to its root?
Yeah, so raising it to its root is that everything really has its root in God. Everything really has its root in good. So when you have something that's fallen or distant and appears to be negative, you got to bring it up to the good. And then you're restoring it to its rightful, natural, original place. Okay. Yes.
So when we went around the room, there were a couple people that were really honest and said, this part of the service, I just schmooze with my friends. I find that hard to believe that that's something so important and so vital in somebody's life. Not to say that anything you do during prayers, that's so important that has to be elevated to the point of prayer,
right?
Of tefillah.
Yeah. So I have two responses to that. The first is that he's really thinking about thoughts, intrusive thoughts, and less thinking about intrusive people or intrusive behaviors. I think that he's really imagining someone who is trying their best and then finding themselves sort of attacked on all sides. But to your question, I do think that sometimes talking in shul is extremely important. Sometimes someone hasn't been in shul for a while because they've been feeling disconnected. Yeah. And if when they come into shul, nobody turns around to smile at them, nobody shakes their hand, coming to shul just made things worse. So, you know, engaging in a 45-minute conversation with someone about, you know, whether or not some 108-year curse has just ended might not necessarily be the most pressing matter of prayer.
I'm from Chicago.
Oh, good. I chose a good example. I think sometimes there is a place where something that seems like it might be a distraction or an interruption is critical to having that poor prayer feel like they can join the minyan, and the minyan is there for them, and sort of that like synced up experience of prayer. But that's just coming from me. I don't think he's saying that. Yeah, Anita.
I was just going to say children. That's one of the things that people, you know.
Right.
Are they distracting? Should they be there? They're making noise.
Right. And I think that just like with a conversation to make somebody feel welcome in shul, there's my personal feeling about children in shul is that there's a limit also.
Right.
Right. It's both that you want shul to feel like a place that's welcoming to children, and you also want shul to feel like a place that's welcoming for adults.
Right.
And sometimes it's hard to strike that balance. Yeah, Haley.
I would also say that, like, even even an action, like talking to a person, like even if it's just kind of schmoozy and a person you might see, because then you don't need to speak to them at that time, like our actions are prompted by our thoughts. So one could assume that like in this particular instant, there's a thought that provokes you to feel the need to speak to this person, and that thought could be the thing that might that you might need to incorporate into your prayer.
Love it. Especially if your thought is, I'm really bored here. And maybe the response to that is, why am I so bored during davening? What can I do to make davening more meaningful? And the first time you have that thought, it might express itself, and it'd be actually a lot more fun for me to be in shul if I was talking to my friend. But eventually, right, that recognition of when I'm here, I'm not really here, might lead you to do more exploration. Okay, great.
How does this fit into the Mishnah that says that when the nachash comes, you don't interrupt?
Great. When the nachash comes and you don't interrupt, that means you bring this snake along with your prayer. So instead of stopping to pray, to shoo away the snake and say, I don't want to be thinking about, you know, my sick relative right now. Instead, you say, I'm praying now about this sick relative.
Oh.
Right? Of actually bringing, I'm allowing that thing to not interrupt me, but to actually become my prayer. Yeah.
I have a technical question about the way I'd like to know, and I don't know if you can answer this. What you just gave us was fascinating. How did you get that from this text? What did you do to understand this? Because I never would have understood this.
That's a broader question. I'm going to finish the text, and maybe you and I can have a conversation later about how to read and how to read. Because I think that's really the question.
We haven't gotten yet to how do you know the difference between those thoughts that are nachash and those thoughts that are...
We're
still going to get that.
Oh, yeah, we're going to get there.
This is so far, this is nachash.
Mm-hmm.
These thoughts can be elevated, can be incorporated. Now we're going to find out what are the ones that can't. Yes?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to carry with you with me everywhere to just summarize where we are and say where we're going.
I get pretty heavy.
That's great. Okay. Great. We're at Or the Reason. We're about a third of the way down. Or the Reason is towards the end of the sentence. Or the Reason for the one who calls him is for a different aspect. For it is the will of the king to test him. Like the parable of the prince and the harlot, which is explained in the Zohar, which we all learned because we are all Kabbalistic experts. And this is the part that is most significant. And this explanation and this explanation are one. Okay? This is the answer to your question. There is no nachash or akrav. There are just snakes. Something that you think is an akrav actually is a nachash. That is his insight. Right, that the one that's coming to distract you and the one that says, hey, take me with you, I want to pray too, they're the same. Okay, now we're going to explain what he means by that. For the one who calls him is also doing the command of the king. And this applies to he who believes with a complete faith that there is a king in the world who guides it, that is the world. And without God, a person will not lift his hand or his foot, and everyone needs to fear him. But for one who does not believe this with a complete faith, the one who calls him definitely separates him from the king and interrupts him from speaking with him. And this is enough for one who understands, and it is not possible to continue to elaborate, for all of the sheets of paper in the world will not be sufficient to explain one thing, but for the wise, the summary will be sufficient, and the intelligent will understand the matter completely. Okay? So here he's basically saying, I told you something very briefly and very cryptically. I'm afraid to spell it out for you, but if you're smart enough, you will get what I mean. So I don't know if I'm smart enough to get what he means. I'll tell you what I think he means, and if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. Okay, here's what I think he means by the nachash and the akrav. Essentially, when I see a snake, I don't know whether it's dangerous or not. I don't know whether it's avodah zarah or it's machshava zarah, whether it's just a foreign thought that needs to be raised or whether it's a distracting thought that needs to be kicked out. The difference between this snake and this scorpion is not about the snake or the scorpion. It is about you. If you believe that everything comes from God, that snake is a happy snake. It comes to ride along. If you believe that that scorpion comes from some other place, and God did not send it, and it is a distraction, it is a distraction. Your orientation of faith determines whether or not that is a danger or that is an opportunity. And it's not about the thought. And so you might say, this is a I am a man who is an ascetic, and I am having a sexual thought about a woman who is not my wife. And then you have a choice. Sometimes God sends the prostitute to prove the prince. And sometimes prostitutes, you need to run away from them. And sometimes they're avodah zarah. That is your choice. If you believe that everything comes from God, there is nothing. There is no outside. There is no acher. It's all one. And that's a choice that you make by your orientation, by the amount of faith that you have. So you need faith in order to pray, because faith is what tells you, I'm okay. I'm not threatened by this thought. I believe that everything comes from God. I'm going to take it with me. This is an extremely high level of faith. We have to go a little bit more, because I'm going to tell you what I think is radical here, and then we'll have some time for some thoughts or comments or questions. Okay. And this is... Even if there is a snake wrapped around his heel, he should not stop. But if it's a scorpion, he should stop. For a scorpion is explained in the Tikkunim. What is a scorpion? Uproots the home of the Shekhinah. So you'll see in the Tikkunei Zohar box on your chart, we have this nice, it's called the Notari cone, where you basically split up a word. So I have this word akrav. But one way to read this word is akar plus bet. And bet, when you spell it out, spells bite, obviously. And the home is a term that's used to mean woman. Or the way that you say wife in Aramaic is devetu, his house. Okay? Woman is shechina. Bada bing, bada boom. And akrav is something that's coming to uproot the shechina. I left this to the end because I wanted you to have buy-in before I said that. Okay? So the akrav is something that's coming to uproot the home of the Shekhinah. The way that you're going to remember this is homewrecker. Right? This seductress is a homewrecker. You are davening, you're in sexual union with God, and then there's this other lady that comes by, this idolatrous prostitute-y woman, and you are, oh man... This is something that's foreign. This is coming to distract me and separate me from the Shekhinah. Okay. We gotta go through, and then there's gonna be time, I promise. I almost promise. Okay. okay. Heaven forbid. That is that they fell in an absence of faith. And automatically fear will disappear from him, as mentioned before. But for a snake, he should not stop. For to the contrary, he raises the Shekhinah from there, as it were. Blessed is he, and blessed is his name, through the prayer in which he awakens his heart, through seeing the servant of the king who was wearing sackcloth, heaven forbid. How much more so the sons of the king? And they are unable to come before their king and their father. Meaning, if this is what I could say about something that is a bad thought, how much more so for a good thought? So what if I have a Torah thought during davening? Obviously, that's amazing. And this is known through the clear light that my grandfather opened. Okay, I want to say one last thing. Fear, right, is the disposition of this snake is a danger. It might do something to me. Fear is the opposite of faith. And you basically have one option. This is a threat. Then it is a threat. This is totally safe. I can work with this. Then it's no longer a threat. And the secret radical thing that I think that the Degel Mechana Ephraim wants to say but doesn't want to say out loud is, why do you have to stop praying when an akrav comes to you? Why can't you keep on praying? Why can't you just reject that thought and keep on praying? Why do you have to stop? And I think that he is suggesting that if you don't believe in God, which you clearly don't because you think this is a scorpion, what are you praying to? Your prayer becomes avodah zarah, becomes idol worship. Because you don't have enough faith in God to believe that this distracting thought comes to you from God, then whatever you're praying to is not God. And he doesn't want to say that to someone. He doesn't want to say that prayer could be idolatry. But I think that's the next logical step of saying, when it's a nachash, you bring it with you. And when it's an akrav, not that you just reject it, but you have to stop praying. Because actually, in order to pray, you need to have a disposition of faith. You need to be willing to believe that everything can be transformed. Right? So the simple place where he started with, you just have to believe that the world can be different. You just have to pray from a disposition of possibility. But the next stage, and I think, right, the harder stage, and therefore the stage with the more Zohars, is you have to also believe that everything that's negative can be changed through your perception. It's not just concrete things that can be changed. It's abstract spiritual truths that can be changed. And it's your power and it's your faith. So we have 5 minutes left, so I really want to take comprehension questions first and then any insights or questions that are not comprehensive. Yeah.
I just want to say, it seems like in your sense, it's a little hard to believe on some level, that there, if you're a person of faith in this way that Swedish said, there's nothing that's clustered to think about. Or maybe think about as too active of a verb. Because that's what's being said. Turns out.
Right, so I think that he's not saying, oh, if you have a thought of this idolatrous practice, or you have a thought of this woman who's not your wife, you should spend all of your prayer dwelling on it. He definitely would not say that. But he might say, find a way to transform it. And this is, right, of course, what he doesn't explain to you how to do. This is actually what's really difficult. He doesn't tell you how. Mm-hmm. Beyond, have faith. Well, that's very helpful. Mm-hmm. Right, so there... The only recipe that he has for you is don't get upset about it. Don't try to reject it. Center yourself with everything comes from God and everything goes to God and everything's going to be fine. She's coming to tend me. I'm going to be okay. This is going to make my prayer stronger. But there isn't really much beyond that he's giving you to do. But yes, right, you're supposed to look at this as an opportunity.
To bring it with you,
either through transforming it or through just... looking at it in a different light.
Recreating.
Great. Any broader questions or comments that you want to make? Yeah, Les.
It's similar to how when certain therapeutic circles talks about anger. The anger is your response to an outside influence. That's your response. The anger is not coming at you. So, therefore, you have to figure out why your response is what it is and you can transform it or not, you know. But it's kind of, I mean, you know, outside of Hasidic, you call this maybe religious existentialism. In other words, you're saying that's the fact, that you can deal with it in any way you want, including
right.
a transformative way, but it's yours to deal with.
Right. These foreign thoughts, they're not coming from outside,
no,
they're coming from inside.
That's you.
Right, there's no such thing as a foreign thought.
That's true. Now...
Great.
How do I deal with that truth? I mean, you've got to look at it outside of the... It's very...
Thank you.
Would you say that a takeaway from all of this is that... Because you started by asking us during what prayer are you distracted? You know? And everyone said different prayers and we're distracted by all kinds of different things, right?
Right.
You know? So would you say the takeaway is that whenever you find yourself being distracted, find a way that whatever it is you're thinking about, that's not the Amidah, or that's not
right.
the Shema, or not whatever it is that you're supposed to be davening, that you take that, whatever it is that you're thinking about, and turn it into a transformative experience that is in worship of God.
Yeah, if you can.
You know. No, I'm just trying to turn this into a tachlis discussion, that's all.
Yeah. No, I think that you know, you both pointed to the weakness here is that the the idea is very strong, but the tachlis is very difficult to exactly mm-hmm. figure out what you're supposed to do and how you're supposed to apply this. I agree.
And, you know, I don't think we're all thinking about prostitutes and sexual thoughts. And, I mean, yeah, that's sort of very strong,
right.
You know. But there are things that you, you know, there's something that happened the day before, that morning, whatever you're doing, and trying to figure out what you're going to do after you're davening.
Right. Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
This seems awfully judgmental. It's kind of like, if you're distracted, it's your own damn fault.
Yeah.
You should be able to raise up any distraction to a higher level. If you can't do it, it's a weakness in you. And where it doesn't give us help in doing that, it leaves me with a sense of my failure that I haven't been able to do that, and doesn't give me much to go on to be able to do that. If I can do it, great for me. If I can't do it, well, I screwed up and I came up short. I'm looking for a little bit of something to help me do that.
Great. So I'll tell you the way that it feels positive to me, although I definitely hear this critique. What I think we're all challenged by, and now I'll speak as we, because we all said we were distracted in prayer, is like, we want to be less distracted. And we beat up on ourselves for being distracted. Mm-hmm. And I think what the Degel Machane Ephraim is saying is, don't beat up on yourself for being distracted. The only thing you should beat up on yourself for is getting upset about it. Mm-hmm. It's like, if you can just accept it and work with it, you'll be fine. And that I actually find to be very reassuring as someone who is very easily distracted. Suzanne, you have the last word. Good. Well played. Yeah,
no,
Suzanne.
I found this very freeing. First of all, I just want to call the vote. You got it all done, and I totally understand it, and that's really amazing. I loved you before, but now I really love you more.
Thank you.
And I found this very freeing. I hope freeing.
Free.
I found it very freeing and affirming and humanizing, and I'm like, oh, okay.
Good.